Welcome to the documentary In the Studio from the BBC World Service, the programme that investigates the creative process. I'm Sea Benedict. Sydney Harbour is home to the most iconic opera house on earth, and the national company, Opera Australia, is resident there. When it opened in 1973, you could go and see operas like Puccini's La Bohème, Rossini's The Barber of Seville, and Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. Now, over 50 years later, you can go and see operas like Puccini's La Bohème, Rossini's The Barber of Seville, and Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. But a handful of stops down the train line is a refurbished railway works. It's metal and concrete and almost completely inappropriate for an opera company. That's where Sydney Chamber Opera has been based since 2011. And in partnership with Opera Australia, they're about to stage a new Australian opera called Gilgamesh.
One thing that you've been perfecting over, I guess, probably the last few months is describing the plot of Gilgamesh in fewer and fewer words. How many words do you think you can do it in today?
Let's give it a try. Gods try and control a king who falls in love and realizes what life and death are.
Ooh, that's so few words. That's so few words.
That's Sydney Chamber Opera's artistic director and Gilgamesh's composer, Jack Simons. And let's add a few more words to that. The Epic of Gilgamesh is one of the world's oldest written down stories. This version, with a libretto by Sydney Chamber Opera co-founder Lewis Garrick, begins with a despotic king.
That's Gilgamesh.
The gods sent him a half-man, half-beast.
That's Enkidu.
Who's supposed to destroy him, but
they fall in love.
And instead of love making them soft, they go on a rampage together. There are burnt forests, ransacked cities, and Enkidu dies. Gilgamesh goes off on a mad quest for immortality.
Along with some dancing scorpions and a bull of heaven.
All of this is achieved by five singers.
We've built up an ensemble cast of people who are expert at owning the stage by themselves.
Jeremy Kleeman in the title role, Mitchell Riley as Enkidu. Mitchell actually sung the very first note in the very first performance by Sydney Chamber Opera. There's the tenor, Daniel Todd, and there's two female voices, Jane Sheldon and Jess O'Donoghue. There are also two instrumental ensembles working together.
I was looking for a piece that could bring together two of the ensembles that I've worked with most frequently and recently and have played my music the best, and they are the Australian String Quartet and Ensemble Offspring. And I thought, what a wonderful way to try and bring these two really virtuosic groups, some of the best practitioners of new music in the country, bring them together to make a kind of supergroup.
And that supergroup assembly extends into the production team with director Kip Williams, whose Sydney Theatre Company production, The Picture of Dorian Gray, transferred first to London's West End and now to Broadway. He's a long-term Sydney Chamber Opera collaborator.
He has an incredible ability to know when one tiny millimetre is different than what he imagines in his head. And we'll notice that in the midst of thousands of things happening on the stage. It's quite wonderful. It's like, as a conductor, it's like listening to, you know, one person doing the wrong bowing in a whole orchestra.
But before we get to Kip, or even to a rehearsal room, there is just a score.
There are reams and reams of pages in writing that only I can decipher. It kind of looks like some of the tablets of the Epic of Gilgamesh. And only thereafter do I then do the very laborious task of making what in opera is very necessary to rehearse with, which is a vocal score, where all of the instruments get reduced down into staves that one poor rehearsal pianist has to play. Everyone has that now. I'd say that took at least 30 days of work to do that, but it's invaluable. Also, it's great feedback for me as the composer, to me as the vocal score writer, that you see all the details that are necessary, and sometimes I cut things that are eventually unnecessary, and it's like, oh, well, I didn't actually need to have that much elaboration of that detail to achieve that effect. So it's like giving myself a composition lesson in making that reduction and looking quite coldly and critically at the material to find its most essential nature in order to represent it in rehearsals, because that's what the singers and the creative team, the director and the designers, will hear for 6 weeks until all the instruments finally come in the last week and a half. So it's like they're trying to negotiate and stage a work totally in black and white without any colour filled in.
You've given them the score. They probably cannot read the score in the detail that is required for them to fully understand what you're envisaging.
And then you presumably have many, many conversations in which you say what you've done. Are you good at those conversations? Are you capable of articulating what you've articulated on the page?
Well, that's probably the biggest advantage of having to do it for lots of other premiere operas. It's finding a language that articulates what it feels like theatrically and the points of climax and the points of relaxation and how the singers will be relating to each other, the length of time that each interaction takes, how long transitions are, where there's resonance, where there's dryness, all of these extremes and binaries that happen throughout that music is made from. That's the kind of information they need to know. And so I make a big marked up annotated score where I say all that. I just point to things in the score. I write them across the whole many hundred pages. I say, this will feel like this. This will sound like this. This will be loud. This will be soft. This will be denatured. This will be pure. This will be really harsh. This will be really clean. This will be consonant. This will be dissonant.
The way that Gilgamesh will come together is layer by layer, adding elements until that stack of pages of Jack and Lewis's becomes 17 people and 4 different kinds of confetti spread across Carriage Works' vast concrete floor for almost 3 hours. First step is music rehearsals, getting the cast into that score. When I go to visit music rehearsals, they're at a spot called The Church. It's a deconsecrated little parish chapel wedged between a post office and a row of townhouses in Sydney's inner west. But not everybody is there.
The two leads actually live in Europe, and it's not a glamorous process. It is note by note, bit by bit, but part of the joy of having these people that have worked with a lot, especially the Sydney ones like Jane Sheldon and Jessica O'Donoghue, is that there's an unspoken language we have now that I don't need to say so much to get what I want. They know the kinds of colours and sounds and the expressions that I'm going to ask for, and that's just preempted. So really, it cuts the rehearsal time more than in half when you have such a shared trust and collaboration with people that you've been working with for so long.
Jane and Jess are the two female voices in the cast. They play between them gods, goddesses, priestesses, courtiers, immortal royals, and those dancing scorpions Jack mentioned earlier. They're also both composers in their own right, brilliant, kooky, thoughtful opera makers, and foundational members of Sydney Chamber Opera, which for both of them felt very different to any other operatic career that might have been waiting for them.
When I embarked on my opera career, which was fairly traditional, like I did my Bachelor of Music, and then I did a Diploma of Opera, and then I did Young Artist Programs, and on this journey I just became increasingly despondent and saddened by the genre and how dead it was, really. It wasn't a living, breathing, evolving genre. It was just a means to trot out these ancient works that were increasingly not only irrelevant but damaging in the narratives. And I just walked away. I'm like, okay, what am I going to do? I need to restart. Maybe I'll start exploring my sort of jazz and contemporary roots again. And when I was in that phase, I got approached by Jack saying, we're doing this new opera. I'm like, oh, sorry, mate. Too late. I don't do opera anymore. He's like, no. Come and let's have a chat. And so we had a chat and, yeah, I just immediately resonated with all the things that he said around what they were trying to do. And I'm like, well, this is what I thought and hoped opera could be. I just never found it. I was called Sydney Chamber Opera, my spirit company. Mm. It's just like, I love the process, I love the works, I love their intentions and their philosophies. And yeah, I'm a convert. Mm. And similarly to Jane, I've been working with them ever since.
My involvement with the company came at a really good time because I was at the end of my 20s and already sort of jack of of the sort of narrowness of the path laid out for singer trained in the Western classical tradition. And I could see there wasn't going to be a place for me in the conventional setup. So I was starting to collaborate with people who were more simpatico, and yeah, it was a good time for me to meet SEO.
Right from the get-go, it's the composer, it's the performers, it's the designer, it's the director, it's the dramaturg, all working together to create a work that we all know is going to be successful in the end, because what you have in the alternate version is basically trying to solve problems that are inherently in the work. And you can only do that to a certain extent, but we don't come across that because we solve those problems as the work is being created.
The slightly awkward thing here is the fact that Opera Australia is one of those older, more established companies, and that they're producing partners for Gilgamesh.
It's the first time Sydney Chamber Opera has worked with our big, old national opera company. Soon before I started following this process, the company announced a British stage director called Jo Davies as the new artistic director. She said her priorities for Opera Australia were gender parity, new work, and Australian work. And when she was interviewed about her first season in the job, she said how excited she was for Gilgamesh, something that was perhaps a little out of character for Opera Australia in recent years.
It was helpful to us in a way that for the last decade, essentially Opera Australia has focused on the classics. It allowed SCO to eke out a space. Now we can be partners in something rather than being the scrappy competitor. So, yeah, it does feel like the natural, I don't want to say culmination makes it feel like the end of the company, but it does feel like the natural conclusion of where we've been aiming for the last decade without becoming, you know, institutionalized in any way. It's a classic SCO show in a way. It's all of our musicians and all of our singers and all of our theatre artists. It just happens that now they're part of the larger story of opera by being included in Opera Australia and having this collaboration.
In some ways, these music rehearsals are about the singers learning the music, but they've been involved in the process for longer than the score has existed.
I have a scene in this opera that has an extended section where the vocal timbre requested in the score is Jane Whale, one word. And this sound, oh, I mean, very fun for a singer to be asked by a composer. What would a sound be that feels perfect in your voice that contains so much humiliated rage that its unleashing can destroy the universe? When, like, that's just like a dream text message. So this Jane Whale in the score is a sound that Jack and I kind of played with and found together. So we had to find a sound that actually has like a really fine onset and can just like be kind of very aggressively but sensually kind of surfed across these pages, where the intensity could be maintained, but I hopefully wouldn't actually, as Jane, die. So the score contains some things like that, which are pretty fun.
You know, what people who are more familiar with traditional opera will probably recognise is a slightly different timbre and sound to the voice. And part of my frustrations around being an artist in traditional opera was you're only allowed to make one sound, and that is that warbly, very heavily vibratoed. You know, it's very beautiful at times, but as an artist, you'd like to have the freedom to choose what is the most appropriate sound for the music, for the narrative, for the emotion that you're trying to express.
One of the things that makes traditional opera voices sound warbly, like Jess says, is the fact that they generally have to sing to the back of a very big room, completely unamplified. What makes all of the things that the singers are going to get to do in Gilgamesh possible is amplification, modern technology, but it's born out of necessity with Sydney Chamber Opera's residency at Carriage Works, a space that wasn't built with the human voice in mind.
Yeah, so the work is sound designed. I wrote it with that in mind and with that as an advantage rather than a headache to solve. But it is a large architectural space. It's a big space to fill. With the right focusing of the stage space, it can feel very intimate or epic. And I think that's really right for this piece.
I mean, how exciting to try to imagine, like, what would the language, the sonic utterance of the gods sound like? You know, Jack's talked about the fact that he doesn't want them to be mistaken for humans. Like, this sound world has to be quite different. And so just the scope of what you can do once you've got electronic manipulation in a work is quite exciting. But also, like, I'm a person who, I don't particularly enjoy singing, for example, with symphony orchestra. And the reason is because it's not a fair fight. And in order to do it, I have to abandon all sense of nuance. I mean, there are a whole lot of voices that are built differently from mine and do a gorgeous job, and I love hearing them sing with symphony orchestra. But for me, just leaving nuance at the door simply so I can make enough sound to be in the ring is like not artistic work that I find at all satisfying. And in a setting where amplification is used, it's just so simple to make that someone else's job. And then I can give a performance that's full of nuance and subtlety, and it's a whole other dimension to play with.
You're listening to the documentary in the studio from the BBC World Service. I'm C. Benedict, and you just heard Jane Sheldon talking about her role in Gilgamesh, a new Australian opera. And everything is going pretty smoothly, up to a point. Hey, Jack, what happened to your floor?
A large Fazioli piano went through it. So it's there's two Faziolis in this room. The plural of is also Fazioli. And it's a luxury to have such an amazing instrument, but yes, it's too heavy for a heritage listed floor.
Luckily, the staging rehearsals aren't taking place on top of that heritage listed pothole. The cast and creative team of Gilgamesh move from the church to the opera centre, but suddenly it's a pretty weird time. I'm walking up to the Opera Australia rehearsal rooms to talk to Kip Williams, who's the director of Gilgamesh. But the big news is that Joe Davies, who's the artistic director of Opera Australia, has stood down this week. I really didn't see that coming. She's been there less than a year, and this season looked really interesting. But they've been really frank about it and said that they couldn't come to an agreement on how to balance innovation and commercial considerations. This is a big deal for lots of these companies. And I don't know if anyone on the Gilgamesh team will talk to me about this. And I don't know, I couldn't really blame them. They've got to keep working in this quite small industry. Here it is, the Opera Centre. It's so funny. It looks like a 70s tyre factory or something. It's sort of red and grey and like totally unassuming in some ways. I came here for a tour in high school. It looks exactly the same. Nothing's changed in 20 years. Nothing's changed. The rehearsal room itself is scattered with confetti and broken tree branches. The walls are covered with design sketches and reference images. There's an almighty sound rig pushed into a corner behind the grand piano. And on the other side of the piano, director Kip Williams.
The very first thing that I directed professionally was in part a piece written by Jack Symonds.
Does it feel like a full circle moment?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's been 13, 14 years of creative conversation in between then and now. But to be doing arguably, I think, his biggest creation yet, yeah, it's pretty special and does feel full circle.
And being in this room, it's huge.
Yes, and this room is not even nearly as big as what the theatre is going to be. So we're in Bay 17 at Carriage Works, which will probably be about 5 metres deeper than this space and 5-6 metres wider. You know, like any good rehearsal room, we're using our imagination to try and imagine what it's going to be like in this space. But I don't think until we're in there we'll fully understand the magnitude of the chasm that is Bay 17. And also in this piece that so much of it is about this relationship between mortals and the gods, the kind of incredible height above the performers as well, add a whole new dimension. So, you know, I think as a storyteller, you feel like you are part of a continuum of passing on myths and narratives, and they pass through you and you shape them as they pass through you, and you hope to redefine them, sometimes radically, for the times in which you're living. But I was particularly drawn to Jack and Lewis's interpretation of that myth and how contemporary it felt, that it's a story that really looks at the battle that a human being has with their ego. You know, Gilgamesh is a very narcissistic, solipsistic individual, and we meet them at the top of the piece at a point in time where that self-obsession and ego is so writ large that it's having a kind of catastrophic impact upon the world, both the people of Uruk but also the natural world, and in particular a story about that person ultimately having to come to terms with the consequences of their ego and accept their mortality. I saw within that a resonant and important story for contemporary audiences to engage with.
I'm interested in that contemporary look at it as well, because grappling with the idea, I think especially in Australia, you know, this is so tangentially related, but I had this conversation with a guy in a whiskey bar a few weeks ago, and he was talking about how all the Australian whiskey distilleries are trying to figure out what will make Australian whiskey taste like an Australian whiskey so that people overseas know that it's Australian when they sip it. And I kind of wonder whether I can laboriously extend that metaphor to this conversation. Is there any point in trying to create an Australian opera practice?
There's absolutely a point, Tony. Yes. I mean, I can speak to Sydney Chamber Opera insofar that there's the work they produce, but there's also the artists that they invite in, the types of singers they invite in, and the types of theatre makers that they invite in to make work. It feels quite radical in that they approach opera making like it's theatre. And I'm working with these incredible singers exactly the way that I'd be working with actors. It's a very experimental process. It's a very playful process. It's not that traditional notion of opera where it's like stand here and move your arm on this beat and turn and face the person on this note. That history that I have with the company and that Elizabeth Gadsby, the designer, and David Fleischer, the costume designer, have with the company as well as with these performers who worked inside it give us not only a shorthand but a freedom to experiment and to, I suppose, reinvent what our understanding of opera might be for today. I don't know if that makes it uniquely Australian, but it feels like there's a uniquely Sydney Chamber Opera spirit at the centre of this work.
Jack spoke about five companies essentially coming together to make this. Do you feel like that's the future of stage work in Australia?
I think all collaboration is good. But I do think that the collaboration between Opera Australia and SCO and Australian String Quartet, Ensemble Offspring, and Carriage Works is unique and is very much driving the uniqueness of this particular work of art and uniting a series of artists and theatre makers and crews who wouldn't usually necessarily come together to make something, because like we're doing something that we haven't done before.
And finally, the Gilgamesh crew migrate from the Opera Centre to Carriage Works Bay 17.
As the name implies, it's where they used to make train carriages. And it's been converted into two theatres, one very big one and one quite intimate chamber space. They're concrete bunkers with a sense of post-industrial, I don't want to say chic, but they...
I think it's chic. I think it's a chic place.
Yeah. But they have quite a wonderful atmosphere. Importantly, designers and directors love working in them because, yes, there's lots of problems with working in things that weren't constructed to be a theatre. Of course, there's lots of headaches with like, oh, that wall has a kink in it there and like there's a piece of graffiti from 1930 on that bit of wall. That brick just sticks out and won't go in. But like once you accept what the space is, it does have its own kind of atmosphere.
And this is the atmosphere of opening night. After more than 3 years on the page, more than 5 months on the piano and 6 weeks in the rehearsal room, through collapsing church floors and corporate political dramas, Gilgamesh opens in its industrial chic concrete bunker. The rehearsal stage seems tiny in comparison to the huge flat floor of Bay 17. The rehearsal confetti seems paltry compared to the layers of silver, gold, and red that start heaping the stage. The huge, hard box of the room is resonating with the voices, the players, the electronics, the uncanny sound design. It swells around you and it's epic. Opera is, even by theatrical standards, extremely ephemeral. After all that, there are 6 performances of Gilgamesh in total. And then it's over for now. I catch up with Jack one more time, up in Sydney Chamber Opera's little shipping container-sized office at Carriage Works, wedged between other arts companies in their own shipping containers. He's had a week or so to take a breath.
I mean, performing it and having to take the time to enjoy it at the time, that takes about as much brain capacity and physical capacity as I've got as a person.
I heard that you were still rehearsing sort of like 5 shows in.
Oh, well, we always tighten things. Sometimes these things get into a habit that might be, you know, 0.5% different from the score in a rehearsal, that every day it increases and inches forward, encroaching into inaccuracy, and then you just have to kind of nip that in the bud after it reaches a certain point.
And nothing quite so comedically catastrophic as the piano falling through the floor in the music rehearsals.
We almost did have to stop opening night in the middle of the first act. Mitch Riley, one of the very physical performers playing Enkidu, ran into a tree stump and had the most enormous bruise, winded himself, almost couldn't go on, was bleeding. We had to hold the audience coming back for the second half, and like he thought he could proceed. We raced him to emergency after the show to check he hadn't had a fracture, and thankfully he hadn't. But yes, that was as close to disaster right on opening night as we've gotten.
That seems like a really classic Mitchell Riley moment. He throws himself at the world, right?
He sure does. And in this case, yeah, the tree stump was pretty unyielding.
You told me at the beginning of this process that perhaps this collaboration with Opera Australia felt like a natural conclusion to the SEO story so far. Did it feel like that in the end?
Yeah, it did. I mean, it was our largest work. It's our most ambitious piece. It's the most people that have ever seen an SEO show, so that felt great. And it did feel like we were making, yeah, like a capital O opera as part of an opera season, although artistically all on our own terms.
Yeah, you've got that incredible sort of family. Is it really enough to call it an opera family?
Oh, no. I mean, it does feel like that after you rehearse so much together and you learn every tick of someone and you sort of see their life cycle. I mean, you only see them from 9 a.m. to sometimes quite late in the evening when you're rehearsing in the theatre, so you don't see their private life, but it feels like it's their inner life. I mean, several of the singers said to me actually in this show that it feels like a privilege to be able to live out their sort of inner fantasies, that so few people in the world actually get to live their inner life on stage in front of a lot of people, and they have to remember to come back to reality after it, because that's, we don't get to do that very often.
From Sumerian tablets to page to stage, that is Gilgamesh. You've been listening to the documentary In the Studio from the BBC World Service, which was presented and produced by me, C. Benedict.